welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. Farmers in South Sudan's Western Equatorial State appeal to the national government to improve road network.
There is poor connectivity. And of course, another challenge is the weak private sector.
And a South Sudan researcher says humanitarian response to the crisis in Sudan is not enough.
So if you look at Unity and you look at Upper Nile, what you basically have is politicians waging a form of demographic warfare by trying to corral and control returning populations from South Sudan, from Sudan. And many of those populations themselves are being moved into contested areas.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The world recently marked Earth Day, and the theme of this year's celebration was Planet versus Plastics. Why? It is because the issue of plastic pollution is a serious environmental problem around the world. VOA's Rick Pantaleo spoke with Sheila Agrawal Akan, Director of the Industry and Economic Division at the United Nations Environment Program, about plastic pollution in Africa and the world and some of the problems it causes.
As you know, Africa actually produces some of the least volumes of plastic. Something like 5% of plastic is actually produced there. And in fact, consumption is also very low, about 16 kilos per person, compared to a global average of 45. And in some of the high plastic consumption countries, as high as 136 kilos per person. So Africa, in terms of production and consumption, is very low. Yet the immensity, you could say, of the problem is huge. And so you see from all across the value chain of plastics, you see chemicals and from plastics leaching out into the environment. And there's increasing studies showing that there's an exposure risk from the chemicals that are leaching out. And then there's, of course, a waste management issue, which is very evident in the rivers and oceans, where you see plastic pollution or plastic bags all over the place.
Why do you think plastic pollution has gotten so out of hand?
Well, I think the first thing is, of course, that most plastic is only recyclable in theory, right? I mean, you see a lot of plastic products where it has a nice recycle sign, but actually in reality, only 10% of plastic produced, even globally, is recycled. And that's because, on the one hand, there's mostly mechanical recycling facilities. In Africa, even less so. But the chemical recycling facilities are high cost, high environmental footprint, at least today, those technologies that exist. And so most plastic is not being recycled. A lot of plastic that we're seeing is now single use and short lived, especially in the packaging space, not enough reuse. And then, of course, even when it comes to recycling, there's a lot of worry about the chemicals that are in plastics and some of the problematic polymers. So you end up with a situation where there's not enough reuse and there's not enough waste management and recycling. And so unless you look at design issues right from upstream, you're not going to be able to solve the problem. And so Africa is in a situation where it's receiving a lot of plastic and doesn't know how to cope with the scale of the growth in plastic production that is ending up not just as waste, but across the life cycle has its own set of environmental and human health exposure issues.
And finally, the fourth session of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee to develop an international legally binding instrument on plastic pollution, including in the marine environment, is taking place until April 29th in Ottawa, Canada. Can you tell us what is hoped to be accomplished at this meeting and how will it address the issue of plastic pollution?
So member states negotiating the treaty right now are looking to seeing how do they deal with many different issues across the entire life cycle of plastics. So all the way from polymers of concern to chemicals in the plastics, and what do they do when they see a harmful situation and look at alternatives. So they need to put in place the thinking about how to deal with alternatives.
That was Sheila Agarwalkan, the director of the Industry and Economy Division at the United Nations Environment Programme. UNEP hosted a meeting in Ottawa, Canada, to develop a binding international treaty on plastic pollution. Still on environment, an official in Upper Nile State Forestry Department says floods affected a large chunk of forests across the state. Authorities say lack of transportation has prevented them from reaching remote parts of the state where residents are cutting down trees for charcoal. Mamer Abraham Kwart reports for VOA from Malakal.
Joel Munyok, Director of Administration and Finance at the Upper Nile State's Directorate of Environment and Forestry, says the main cause of deforestation in the state is illegal logging of trees. Munyok says floods have also contributed to deforestation of some parts of the state.
We discover that most of the trees dry up due to the flooding. Especially in these previous 3 years, you can get the whole forest have stagnant water. When the water stays so long, immediately you get those areas, the trees dry up.
Munyok says his office is sensitizing communities on the importance of protecting the country's forest.
Challenge is mobility, because we supposed to deploy our team to move around to get those who are cutting forest illegally. What we normally do, we use to regulate, and we have a specific trees which people can use for charcoal. However, you cut, and after 2 to 3 years, you get the area as the trees. What we are fearing is those who are cutting use the machine, and those who are just entering the forest without instruction, and some use a machine which totally damage the whole forest.
Malakal town resident Kong Yot says the country's vicious cycle of violence has contributed to deforestation in Upper Nile State. He says conflict leads to lack of food, forcing residents to survive on trees for fuel and other economic activities.
If there is an outbreak of the war, this can affect the environment. People cut trees, this can also affect the environment. If there is a war in the location, this also can affect the environment because there would be a shortage of food. For example, now, most of the people, they usually cut the tree because if they cut the tree, they make it as charcoal.
South Sudan's Forest Policy 2012 was formulated to broadly protect the roles forests play in the ecological stability of rivers, lakes, swamps, and agricultural production systems. It also meant to ensure that there are optimal benefits from forestry and agroforestry activities for food security and to poverty alleviation among our rural communities. The policy also integrates forest sector actions with rural development efforts to ensure that the rural population of South Sudan shall have access to basic needs, which include sustainable household food security, shelter, wood fuel, safe clean water, sanitation and health facilities, primary education, good local governance, empowerment and self-reliance. According to IOM, South Sudan's Forest Policy 2015 requires community members to pay taxes for forest products. The policy also states that communities should delineate and gazette forests for proper management. For VOA News, I am Amira Bramquad, reporting from Malakal, Upper Nile State.
Still on matters to do with the forest, farmers in Western Equatorial State say poor road connectivity makes it hard for them to sell their crops in big markets. The chairperson of the Yambio Farmers Agribusiness Cooperative says security in the state has improved and farmers have had good harvest. Juliana Shiapai recently visited Yambio and has this story from Juba.
Anthony Ezekiel Ndupo is the chairperson of the Yambio Farmers Agribusiness Cooperative. He says farmers are appealing to the national government to build more roads to link farmers to markets across the country.
Our federal roads, which leads to our productive areas, the federal roads are really very bad because some people, they can cultivate 50-60 kilometers. But the road which is leading to those places is very bad, and other places also that we can cross the bridge to reach, so whereby the vehicle cannot go.
The World Food Program has been working since 2018 to strengthen the capacity of South Sudan's smallhold farmers and improve food security through increased production, reduced food losses, and enhanced access to markets. Peter Leroux is a WFP Agribusiness Development Officer in Juba. He says road connectivity to markets in Yambia remains a big challenge for farmers.
There is poor connectivity, and of course another challenge is the weak private sector. The weak private sector here poses a lot of challenge. You know, the private sector is supposed to offer certain things such as inputs and so forth, which support the farming system. The private sector here is too weak to support. And then, of course, the current inflation. The inflation is affecting everybody, including the farmer. The fluctuating prices and instability of the South Sudanese pound.
Yona Robert Mack is the State Minister of Cooperative and Rural Development. He says farmers in Western Equatorial State work very hard to produce food. He called on the WFP to train farmers so they can boost food production in South Sudan.
So I urge WFP to put effort also in area of mechanization of agriculture. So where tractors need to be involved in farming system, especially when our farmers, they are having the farms which more than 50 or 60 hectares. So this wants mechanization and use of technology, and also need WFP also to put effort together with support of the government in the area of the training, because it's very important also to train our farmers in the area of farming as a business.
Amos Valerio Rumba is the chairperson of Gitikiri Society in Bazungua Payam. He says the WFP is helping farmers by buying their produce.
And then we have a lot of produce in Gitikiri, so, but the lack of transport to transport our production from Gitikiri to Yafa is very challenging to us.
Farmers say agribusiness training through the WFP in Yambio has equipped them to increase harvests, invest in agriculture, and diversify their livelihoods. For VOA News, I am Juliana Sherpai in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, researchers say Sudan's instability threatens the national security of South Sudan. Find out why and how after this break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The one-year conflict in Sudan is having its side effects felt in South Sudan. Researcher Joshua Cruz and Raga Macau, who are familiar with the two countries, say the conflict will add more suffering on the people of South Sudan.
How is your focus on the crisis in Sudan spilling over to South Sudan? You just mentioned one item here, stolen goods. What are other implications? There is the influx of the refugees, which is a big problem. But what are some of the things that you see that we don't see?
So the influx of the refugees, and even more importantly, the population called returnees, which is a bad term, because it assumes that these people lived in South Sudan, whereas in many cases, they're South Sudanese who are two or three generations of life in Khartoum. And they're coming to South Sudan, and they're being competed over by politicians as if they were livestock. Why? Because if you have refugees or returnees in your area, then you get vanishing humanitarian funds to populations under your control. So if you look at Unity and you look at Upper Nile, what you basically have is politicians waging a form of demographic warfare by trying to corral and control returning populations from South Sudan, from Sudan. And many of those populations themselves are being moved into contested areas. So one of the places in Unity, Riak, where there's now 60,000 people, is an area contested between Unity and the Roeng administrative area. And that population is being used to stake a claim by the governor of Unity, Nguyen, against the Roeng administrative area. So these flows themselves are explosive. And the abdication of the humanitarian community has been to pretend that they are somehow neutral and technocratic when they are to the bone political questions.
And we will get back to you on the humanitarian issues. Raga, we were talking about the conflict in Sudan and who is supplying arms to either RSF or the Sudan Armed Forces. El Fasher, the town of El Fasher, is now the center of the conflict, has shifted actually from Khartoum to Darfur. And RSF has been, you know, they've been putting out statements that they will take over El Fasher. What is the latest?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, at the moment, the standoff is still very much the case. And I think it's also important to understand that the war in Sudan has been running parallel. I mean, it wasn't just one area and then the other. It's not a matter of it having shifted. It's the fact that it's always been running parallel. RSF has had its operations in Darfur, and at the same time, it's also ran up operations in Khartoum and other parts of the country. It's just the dynamics of where these kind of, you know, conflicts are very much dictated by the particularities of these areas. In Fasher, I would think that because the RSF have kind of, you know, extended socio-economic and political roots, the way they go about capturing areas across Darfur, Fasher included, is somewhat different than the way that they would operate kind of, you know, their battlefield in Khartoum. Whereas in Khartoum, the way that the RSF has been kind of, you know, fighting, capturing, territorizing areas and governing them would be different also than how it's done in a place.
Yeah, looking at the bigger picture, what do you see mm-hmm. as a solution mm-hmm. to this conflict? The Takaddum, this coalition of civil society groups mm-hmm. headed by former Prime Minister mm-hmm. Abdallah Hamdok, mm-hmm. has been consistent in their messages saying they want people to sit on the table. Mm. Is it possible for Sudanese to sit and end this conflict by negotiating? Mm-hmm. And if they are negotiating, what is at stake here? Mm-hmm. Power or resources or what is it?
All of it, really. Both power, resources, division of power amongst these kind of prominent players. But what is never present at the negotiation table is dealing with kind of historical grievances that are a product of, you know,
long-held complaints.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the history of Sudan, near and far, it is a history of sitting at the table and negotiating, right? I mean, the history of Sudanese politics in the last 30 years since the CPA is a history of political settlements through peace agreements. Negotiation isn't a new game in Sudan. It's present. Its guidelines are well known. Sudanese politicians are very well trained on it. The public is attuned to it. But the problem is that once and time again, we do it in a very problematic way. Powerful players only negotiate as much as allows them to retain their place in power and to move forward with a shaky coalition that allows them to maintain themselves and just enough until it all kind of falls apart again and they go to war, and then we repeat the cycle over and over again.
And let me go to Joshua on the humanitarian side effects of the conflict in Sudan. You were telling me that actors in the humanitarian world have not done enough to address these issues that are coming because of the conflict in Sudan. What are you asking them to do?
Well, I think there's three different messages. One is that both Sudan and South Sudan and the region more generally is suffering from a huge humanitarian funding shortfall. And the reason for that is donors think that the conflict in Ukraine is politically more important. And partly the reason for that is an entrenched racism on the part of the donors. So, one, the humanitarians need to be fully funded. But even if they were fully funded, that's not enough. And the reason that's not enough is because the humanitarian response in both South Sudan and in Sudan is a political toy of the government. And the only way to actually deal with that is to engage with it as a political question and to realize that in Sudan, the people actually providing aid are not the humanitarians, who are entirely dependent for questions of access on military intelligence and on the Sudanese army, but instead the emergency response rooms, the communities, the communal kitchens of Sudan. It is sobering at this moment of intense crisis in the Horn of Africa that the states, and I include both Sudan and South Sudan, have absolutely abandoned any pretense of providing services, be they education, health, or food, to their people. But also the humanitarians have largely ceased to function as an effective body that can address the problems of these countries. And in the absence of the state, which is predatory, and the humanitarians, which is technocratic and dominated by donor desires, it is the people of these countries that have been forced to look after themselves, and they've been doing it very well. And what the humanitarians need to do is allow the people of Sudan and South Sudan to determine their own priorities, to determine their own food sovereignty, and to support them with as much money as they can, and stop thinking that the shots on humanitarianism are called in D.C., and not in Kadugli and in Renk.
And the situation in South Sudan is that of is a sort of donor fatigue. In Sudan, there's the issue of access. I mean, we have spoken to a lot of international and local NGOs in operating in Sudan. They are all asking the belligerent groups to give access.
The reason there's donor fatigue is because the humanitarians have been trying to do a top-down, hierarchicalized, donor-driven, like basically European and American-driven humanitarian project for literally 40 years, and it hasn't worked. It's been an abundant failure. So they have to entirely redraw their model, and they need to redraw it around the South Sudanese people who are facing famine, political unrest, and an absolutely collapsed economy. And they realize that they can't look to the humanitarians, they have to look to themselves. In Sudan, if the aid agencies sit and wait for HAC, then my beard is going to grow and grow, John, and I'm worried that it will never look quite as good as yours. Because if they wait for the Sudanese army to give them access, they're never going to do it, because the Sudanese army is literally intentionally starving RSF areas and putting them under siege. The humanitarians have to stop waiting for the permission of the Sudanese army, and they have to start actively supporting the Sudanese people.
Raga, this is a very strong statement here from Joshua. I was going to ask you about the elephant in the room in Sudan, the Islamists,
right,
who have gone very quiet, and they have been there for 30 years plus, ruling the country. Mm-hmm. Where are they in this conflict? Mm-hmm. Are they with Burhan or are they with the RSF?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a lot of rumors, right? I mean, I think also this is part of the problem, that the Sudanese people are obsessed, I have to use this term, with the Islamists, and also their continuing role in Sudanese politics, regardless of whether there was proof for that or not. Having said that, the Islamists are a clear and present danger, and even though they have kind of manifested themselves since the fall of al-Bashir in different ways, the most clear in the years of the transition was their presence in this, you know, the state bureaucracy, and their blocking of any attempts to achieve transition. Later on, during the conflict, it has been the kind of resurfacing of these popular defense armed groups, Difa Ashabi, which is a project
that has been there. I mean, when I finished my secondary school, they wanted me to go to the, Difa Ashabi, and I found a way of escaping that.
Good for you.
Let me give you a final opportunity here, Joshua, to talk about the economy of South Sudan. You saw a contract that is making rounds on the social media between the government of South Sudan and a tycoon in UAE. And this is, we are talking about 13 billion US dollars or euros. Oil has been mortgaged up to 2044. What is the effect of this on generations to come?
So, you know, I'll say something provocative, John, which is if you look at how the oil income has been spent in South Sudan since independence in 2011, it has never gone to the people of South Sudan, not a penny. And if you look at the demarcation of the oil revenue in the document, in the documents with the UAE, 70% of that money is designated for infrastructure projects. And we all know what infrastructure projects mean. We mean that 70% of that money goes to Bolmel and the Old Roads program. And that money vanishes from South Sudan and reappears in bank accounts in the UAE and Nairobi and Dar es Salaam and so on. So in a weird way, this money doesn't affect South Sudan's economy at all, because it's only ever been used to enrich a very limited series of elites in Juba. The real consequence, I think, of this loan, which was first off and now it's on, and now I think the first money, which is not the size of the first tranche, has now been paid last week, is it has basically sold South Sudan to the UAE, and that is part of UAE taking out its checkbook and committing to a regional realignment around the RSF. First, it bought off Chad for the far lesser figure of 1.2 billion in aid and then military assistance, and now it's buying off South Sudan for the enormous figure of 12 billion, which is, let's say, 12 years of the entire South Sudanese economy. And what that does is it prepares the ground for the coronation of Hemeti if Hemeti wins the war. And that itself shows, I think, some of the naivety of the UAE, because this war, like every war in Sudan, is going to end with a negotiated settlement, and it's highly unlikely that settlement will bring forth Hemeti as the ruler of Sudan.
I was speaking with Joshua Cruz and Raga Makawi, both of them researchers who have written extensively about Sudan and South Sudan. They are also familiar with the crisis in Sudan and its ripple effects on South Sudan. And that's all we prepared for you this Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. We now leave you with Nana Yeah featuring Samini and the song Handkerchief. We have been listening to Nana Yeah featuring Samani and that love song from Ghana. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, who comes from Ghana, and engineer Cornelius, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
I do bunny. llegó my dream, oh.